Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us, spending a little bit of your time thinking about some interesting stuff, as we always do on Thursdays. So tonight's guest is going to be a lot of fun. It's Elijah Goldstein, PhD, who's a psychologist in West Los Angeles and the author of The Now Effect, How This Moment Can Change the Rest of Your Life. And I think we're going to have a fascinating conversation. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing, which it seems only appropriate should be about time, since we're going to be talking about now and being present. People don't usually think about time. We just experience time. But when you start talking to scientists about time, they talk about four dimensions. There are three dimensions of space, up and down, forward and backward, side to side, three-dimensional objects. And then there's this fourth dimension that we call time, that in some way that is not easy to figure out or describe is related to space. You can't take a measurement without taking some time to take the measurement. You can't have the sense of linear time and future and past without also having events happening in three-dimensional space. So scientists finally threw their hands up and said, we're going to call it space-time, that it really is all one thing that we function within. Part of it we see as time and part of it we see as space, but it's all the same thing somehow. And that's confusing enough. But when you start really taking that in and some of the other stuff that they talk about linear time not really existing. So for one thing, the past doesn't exist. It's a series of memories that you carry around with you, but it's not something that's here now. And the future doesn't exist. It's just stuff that you're fantasizing about, you're focusing on, expecting to happen at another time, which isn't now, but it's not here now either. So all you have is this present moment, which is what our conversation with Dr. Goldstein is going to be about. But what does that really mean? You know, when you start thinking about our experience of time, what does that mean? And that's really fascinating for people that do shamanic work like I do, because, well, think about the quantum physics explanation about how things manifest in the world. There is an energy pattern, existence, consciousness, however you want to put it, in which all the possibilities that could happen in a particular moment exist simultaneously. Now, this is not the mystical concept. This is the physicists that describe it this way. When you focus on one of the possibilities, what happens is, the term they use is, you collapse the waveform. All the possibilities disappear, and the one possibility that you focused on manifests, and it's what you experience in your life. And now they're doing all this work to find the Higgs boson, the subatomic particle that causes matter to have mass, because we don't know. They think there's this thing that actually makes things have mass, but right now, we don't know why things have mass. And if you don't know how they have mass, all you can do is observe that mass does stuff, like gravity. So when you're doing shamanic work, you're outside of that four-dimensional space-time and in what scientists call non-ordinary reality. You're in a time, in a frame in which linear time doesn't exist. So the past and the future and the present aren't really there. You're experiencing possibilities. And by going into that space, you can change possibilities. You can affect things in the past so things in the present change. You can go into the future and affect things. Pretty strange stuff, huh? But all shamanic work is in this other reality where time doesn't exist, where linear time doesn't exist. So tonight we're going to talk about what happens when you're in the present moment, which is the only thing you can really experience. The only thing we've got is now. And as the joke goes, oops, there it goes. Here's another now. But no, it's gone. Our very precious moments from which we get distracted constantly. So we're going to have some fun talking about what is time and the effect of being present in the present moment. And that's tonight's metaphysical musing, and I hope a really good introduction to Dr. Elijah Goldstein. I mentioned his book is The Now Effect, How This Movement Can Change the Rest of Your Life, and he also worked on a mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook. So he's got a whole methodology as a psychologist based on mindfulness. So, Elijah, so good to have you here with us tonight.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, David. That was a great musing. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I never can tell where I'm going to go with these.
I like this.
So, you know, here you are.
Yeah, what came up? One of the things that came up for me while you were talking about that was when you said the past doesn't exist and the future doesn't exist and all we have is the now. And, you know, one of the things that came up in my mind is, you know, as a psychologist, also as well, we can think of it in a different light, which means basically the same thing, which is, you know, the past does exist and the future actually does exist, but they all exist right now. And
yes.
So, which is saying the same thing. Oh, so it's, in some ways, it's, we could say it both ways, and they're both true, and they both mean
right.
The same thing.
Right, and it's an interesting paradox, and it's from my perspective, and we'll see what you've come up with in your work. The past and the effect of the past is the emotions that we attach to what we experienced in another time. And that energy that gets stored as those emotions is what we're always dealing with in whatever process we're doing, whether it's therapy or it's shamanic work.
Yeah. The way I might even explain that is the way, if we can think of it just as perception, our perception of our emotions, our perceptions of our experience, and the way that our brain makes sense of things is it perceives it, it sees something or it hears something or it feels something in the present moment. That's a sense of our senses, and it reaches back into our memories, as you were talking about, reaches back into our memories to reference, you know, what is this that I'm experiencing right now? Oh, okay, it comes back and says, that's an apple, because I've seen many apples before, and now I can label this as an apple. But first I had to reach back into our memories. And what happens when it comes to difficulties or traumas or, you know, even anxiety or depression or these various things that many of us have experienced to one degree or another, is the brain reaches back when an event happens, and those, what I will call like traumas, because they kind of are in different ways, emotional traumas too, it references those, and that influences the way we perceive what's right in front of us in this present moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are several people that we've had on the show and talked to say that it goes even further than that, that we carry around almost like viruses all of the thought forms about everything that our ancestors, our society, you know, however you want to construct it, all the people that have ever been connected to us, which probably is everybody in the universe who ever existed. You know, all of that stuff is in us, stored completely unconsciously, but still manifesting in the universe as something that has a reality of its own. And there are various methods for working with this unconscious stuff and releasing it. And I find more and more ways and more people doing interesting work. But it's this idea that all of that stuff is stored in us, whether we know about it or not. I call it spyware.
Yeah.
Came from somewhere, but it certainly didn't come from anything that I did or said or thought about. But here it is messing up the program I'm trying to run as my life. So tell me more about your approach and how how you put this together.
Okay, so depending on the degree of the listener's knowledge of mindfulness, let me just kind of start there, which is mindfulness just means awareness. And so I'll briefly just mention this because there may be some people who have a lot of experience with this. It just means awareness as a noun. As a verb, it's the action of mindfulness. It's a process of intentionally paying attention to what's right in front of us, what's being experienced in our life in this moment, while putting aside some of that programming that you were talking about before, while putting aside those biases of that programming. Some people might say, while putting aside our judgments of whether this is good or bad or right or wrong or fair or unfair or whatever it is, so we can actually get in touch with the direct experience of what's here. And one thing that you had mentioned a moment ago, which was, you know, when we get into this thing that's called a space, because there's space and time, we get into this space, we sit in this realm of possibility in some way. It's a space. In that space, you can change possibilities, things from the past, things in the future, which, again, are all collapsing into this moment right now. And the now effect in particular is based on that space. In some ways, it's predicated on a quote by a man named Viktor Frankl, who was which you may know, a psychiatrist and neurologist, and he's a Holocaust survivor, and he wrote Man's Search for Meaning, and so he made meaning even out of his experience of major trauma. And he has this quote that's been attributed to him that says, in between stimulus and response, there's a space. So there's that space. In that space lies our power to choose our response, and in our response lies our growth and our freedom. So in my mind, mindfulness is about tapping into and becoming aware of that space in between stimulus and response and being able to experience that and in that space of the choice point, what I call a choice point, and to be able to choose a response that may be in line with something that's healthier for you or more effective or may lay the foundation for better things to unfold in some way. And so we're kind of in some ways systematically engaging that space, because one thing we know about the brain is that what we intentionally practice and repeat in life oftentimes can become automatic. And why not use that to our advantage? And so, you know, that's a lot about what this work is about. It's about breaking free from the confines of our program biases, whether it's biases that are unconscious from, you know, encoded, that spyware from all over the place, or whether it's biases even just from our generational trauma. Certainly there's been research that just in the field of slavery is up until now, or even to the Holocaust and to now and other cultures, of what's called transgenerational trauma, which is trauma that's carried from generations past, and just to even collapse the idea of being encoded from everything. And so we're learning how to become aware of that reactivity that's happening and relate to it differently with a sense of choice. So the idea is eventually we recognize that we have more choices, more possibilities, more opportunities than we knew were there before. And, you know, this is piercing, you know, all the different sectors of life from healthcare right now to psychology, to politics even, to sports. I mean, it's really kind of infiltrating. It's a business, certainly, in a lot of different ways. And so it's good to see that people want to become more aware.
So, and we live in a world full of distraction where people are both making lots of money and getting a lot of political power by distracting people from that moment where they have a choice and they can look at things clearly and decide what they want to do instead of reacting. So there's a lot of pressure not to make those choices.
Yeah, and deep down, in some ways, we all kind of know. We all have this sense of wisdom in us. At least that's what I believe. A sense of what's right for us to do, or the things that are to connect with the things that matter. And I think that's why a lot of us love, you know, those books that come out. You know, you might remember a book called Tuesdays with Maury, or The Last Lecture, or, you know, these types of. There's another one that came out a couple of years ago called something last sandwich. I can't remember what the name of it was. But anyway, it's all about these guys that they're all guys in these books anyway, that were looking back on their life after having only a handful of moments to live and imparting the wisdom from what they know from that space of preciousness. And so we love those books because we get to read about, oh, yes, this makes sense to me. This feels good. This is about contacting meaning in life and, you know, living alongside what actually matters. But then, as you were talking about, there's a lot of distractions in everyday life, and our brain loves to get distracted. And because there's a lot to pay attention to, especially with these new smartphones nowadays. You know, I'm about to create a retreat. I think that's at least a day long. That's about training all of us to become more aware of how our body, our emotions, and our thoughts are so addicted in a lot of ways to just the sounds and the stimuli that come from these phones. Because some, you know, very smart marketing people and psychologists and other people have figured out, you know, how to really play with our more subconscious reactivity and get us really attached to these things, and so we are. And so there's room to kind of break free from that. Not that phones are a bad thing, or technology in general. They're a very good thing, allowing us to do what we're doing right now, allowing the listeners to, you know, take in through the technology to do that. But how do we skillfully and effectively manage it in a more mature way? I mean, I think that's where our growth lies.
Right. So give me an idea of the kind of presenting client that you would work with and what the approach would be. I'm just curious how it works in your practice.
Sure. So I'll give you just one example. So people oftentimes come to me because they know I have a background in mindfulness and psychotherapy for a while now. And so some people want to actually engage in practice, and some people just like the idea that I hold the philosophy of wanting us to be more present to our lives in some way, and the philosophy of compassion, of how these are important aspects of healing in life. And and so we don't actually do practice, but I would say about for 70% of the people I see, we engage in, you know, mindfulness meditation practices. And so the first thing that we want to inevitably do is kind of allow someone to, when there's a sense of trust, so someone comes in, they're struggling with maybe anxiety, or maybe they have a history of depression, or maybe they've experienced some form of trauma or another, and nevertheless, what they're coming in with is emotional suffering. Because at the end of the day, if we're going to play Jeopardy and say, what's stress, anxiety, depression, trauma, you know, all these things, it's to me, it boils down to emotional suffering. And so someone's coming with emotional suffering and feels stuck on how to, you know, how to work with it, how to heal from it, how to grow from it. And there is a lot to grow from when it comes to our own pain and stress. And so first thing we do is kind of talk about that, about what happened, and be able to kind of start mapping maybe what's going on in the body, really trying to tune someone into the here and now, what's being experienced in the physiological body as we're discussing this. But another layer that we do, because that kind of continues to kind of go on, that idea of that theme of being aware of what's happening in the body, because that, again, tunes us into, helps the brain prime itself to an anchor onto what's actually occurring. But we want to train someone in concentration to some degree. And what I mean by that is we start with a practice that may be a breathing practice of being aware of the breath as it comes in and out, and noticing when the mind goes off and gets distracted. And we just note that. And I ask people to, for a moment, just spend a moment with their actual thought or their image that came up in their mind, and then very gently bring it back to the breath or the body or whatever we're doing in that moment. The reason I do that is because the basic understanding, and I'll bring this up again because it's such an important point, the way our brains work is that what we intentionally practice and repeat in life starts to become automatic. We've actually, you know, mapped out to this point in the last 10 years, probably in the last 5 in particular, the advent of what you and many other listeners may have heard the term neuroplasticity.
Right.
Which is the idea that we can actually shift and grow areas of our brain by the way we pay attention or the different things that we do. It's not just meditation. Other things you know, grow different areas of the brain. And maybe we'll get into, you know, a couple of those studies if there's time. So we're training someone in concentration, so that can start to become a little bit more automatic, so they can, their mind is primed towards being able to be present with what's here. But I'm also doing a different type of training as well. By noticing where the mind goes to and allowing yourself to spend a moment with it, what I think that also trains is it's okay for you to go off the path, meaning that all the self-judgment that usually comes along trying to make change in our lives actually hinders us, moves us further away from the present moment. We want to use that distraction as another anchor to be present with. And then when I say very gently bring our attention back, what we're training ourselves in doing that is we're training ourselves to be gentle with ourselves as we're moving along this path of life. Because at the end of the day, you know, life is great in a lot of ways, but it's also very hard. There's implicitly a sense of stress and pain in life. And so what do we do when that occurs? And there's a certain type of reactivity that we habituate to, which is about trying to get away from the difficulty that's there. And so the more we try and get away from or resist the difficulty that's there, it's the classic phrase, what we resist persists. Mm-hmm. So it exacerbates the issue. It exacerbates what's called the stress cycle, the stress reaction. And so what we want to do is do something very different. And so we're training someone in this certain type of concentration and how to work with a wandering mind. And then we're also training someone to investigate. So again, being present, investigate the actual feeling that's arising in that moment. So again, rather than moving away and avoiding what's here, in other words, the mind judging it as bad and wanting to get away from it, what we want to do is cultivate a sense of curiosity, of approaching. What we do when we approach and we're curious is we actually make a shift in activity in our brain from the area of our brain that's right behind our eyes, that's called the prefrontal cortex, that's involved with our executive function, decision-making, sense of free will, different things like that. The right side of this area of the brain has been more associated with more difficult emotions in our lives. When someone's going through a depressive episode, you'll see more activity in the right side of this prefrontal area. When someone's engaging in compassion practices or feeling good or feeling happy, you'll see more activity going on in the left side of the area. And these are just neuroscience studies that have come out in the last decade. What we want to do is that approach mindset of approaching what's here creates, and being present creates, that kind of left prefrontal shift, which has been associated with resiliency. So we're trying to train someone to be curious about what's here. So another way of looking at that is when we're afraid of a snake, and we keep avoiding the snake, we maintain that fear. And when we're able to approach it and be with it, maybe with some support, and handle it a little bit, over time, it's not so scary anymore, and our nervous system doesn't get so reactive. Mm-hmm. So it is with our difficult emotions as well. If we can learn to approach them in a particular way, and so this is part of the training, to see that when the mind goes off and is avoiding, the moment we notice the mind going off, that's a choice point. That's the moment when you're in a now. That's the now effect. There's an opportunity there. We're in a space and time. The opportunity is to note where it went to. I just got caught in a stress reaction or a difficult reaction, and gently bring our attention back to maybe investigating what's here, being curious about it. Or if it's too overwhelming or too much time, we can make the effective choice to just get distracted or do something else. That's okay. But in the actual therapy hour, we investigate and we get curious and we notice how big the shape is. And what happens is when someone is able to settle into it and do that, is a sense of spaciousness starts to occur. So what we call that is a more open mind. A sense of a more open mind starts to occur. And what that is the actual feeling itself doesn't feel like it's the only thing happening right now. There's more to our experience than just this feeling. And we feel wider and more expansive. And oftentimes what might come up is the thought, it's going to be okay. This is over. This, by the way, isn't in a single hour. Just so we all know. This is over a period of time of working and talking about this and working with this. And it's going to be okay. Or maybe we have a different thought that arises or a belief or a thought comes up that says, I'm really scared, or I don't think I can do this, or I'm unworthy of this or whatever comes up, a belief arises, and we start to see it just as a thought arising, a mental event that's coming maybe from somewhere in their history or somewhere beyond there. And what we start to do is we start to contact this difficulty that's here, and we investigate and we contact it, is another thing starts to arise, which is a sense of compassion, because we're practicing caring about ourselves and paying attention to ourselves. Mm-hmm. So a sense of compassion starts to arise, and when that arises, that's what we say we're moving into a different stage that's called wise mind. Because ultimately, you know, to walk through this world and be more compassionate and caring towards ourselves is a wise thing to do, because it helps regulate our nervous system and opens us up to being more creative, more flexible in our decision making, a number of different things it's been associated with. And as we continue training in this is what a guy, Ron Alexander and I, who are writing a chapter in this, in the Handbook for Mindfulness, have kind of brought down to you, develop this thing called mind strength, which is this ability to have a type of mind where you can more readily and at a quicker pace, I guess, in some way, be able to come down from reactivity and apply what you actually need in that moment, which may be more caring about yourself or getting more distracted or going on a run or doing whatever seems to be best for you in that moment.
We're coming right up on a break. I have a million questions for you. We're talking with Dr. Elijah Goldstein, PhD, the author of The Now Effect. His website is www.ElijahGoldstein, we'll spell that for you a little later, .com. And we're going to be back to continue the conversation here on The Farkas Files on Empower Radio. Don't go nowhere.
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
This bobcat's heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember,
what would happen
adopt.
If you didn't follow the established path? If you did the unexpected? Would you feel scared? Proud? Relieved? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Or assisting an entrepreneur in Ukraine to launch her small business? Or creating a support group in Malawi for children orphaned by AIDS? What if you established your own path? One that others might follow? Would you rather make your own way or spend your life saying, what if? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or go to peacecorps.gov.
The odds of having a boy.
1 in 2.
Who grows up loving baseball.
1 in 6.
And then makes the varsity team.
1 in 20.
Which earns him a college scholarship.
1 in 2,500.
That gets him a contract in the minors.
1 in 3,700.
Which leads to starting shortstop in the majors.
1 in 290,000.
The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism?
1 in 150. You know the odds. Now learn the signs. Go to autismspeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with our guest, Elijah Goldstein, author of The Now Effect. And we were just having a wonderful conversation about how a patient, a client, would be working through things using the mindfulness approach. It occurs to me, and it's one of the things that I tell people to focus on, that many of us have been brought up, trained to complain, that it's the competitive blood sport in many families. Whoever has the best complaints and complains the longest wins. Mindfulness kind of undercuts that and takes you away from telling that story. Is that part of what you do with working with this?
I would say complaining and blaming is another thing too.
Yeah.
In this work, you know, I kind of label those, and this kind of comes a bit from cognitive therapy, but it's mind traps. There's certain types of traps that keep us in a state of suffering. The more we complain, I mean, we can just, if we could take ourselves out of our experience for a moment or be like kind of a scientific observer in some way of our own experience, the more we complain, we'll probably realize that, you know, maybe there's like this tiny, minuscule short-term gain from that in some way, but really it just kind of keeps us stuck into really not feeling well because we're practicing negative thinking. And what we practice and repeat in life, again, becomes automatic. We build those neural pathways that make things automatic. Donald Hebb, psychologist out of, I think, Toronto, I think, which I think you're going to maybe be out there at some point, says neurons that fire together wire together, which is just basically, you know, he didn't go into the brain and actually see that necessarily happening, but it was a great quote that has since kind of become the way we understand neuroplasticity today. And so, you know, it just makes sense. Yeah, if we're practicing complaining, we're practicing blaming, you know, don't be surprised with more of the same happening.
Right.
But more importantly than that, I think, is when we're doing the complaining, if we catch ourselves in that mind trap, that moment we notice that happening, complaining is happening, is a moment we're present, we're in the now. Just even that moment we call that out, we categorize that as complaining, is a moment we're here. There's now a space between our awareness and the complaining or the blaming or whatever it is itself. In that space, as we were talking about in the beginning of that hour, in that space lies our power to choose a response. There's possibility, growth, there's opportunity in there to be able to relate to our experience differently. And to tie it back to that therapy hour, we would take ourselves back to how are we feeling physically? What's the emotion that's here? Research has shown that when you're able to label or name an emotion that's there, it actually downregulates this area of our brain called the amygdala, which is in the emotional center, which is known as the fear circuit. It downregulates that and creates more activity in the area of, in that prefrontal cortex in the front of our brain, which is involved with, you know, a more rational side of things in general.
Right. And,
yeah.
There's a group that does a very simple process called the Complaint-Free World, and they give people wristbands, and the idea is not to complain for 21 days because the usual thought is that it takes 21 days to create a new habit pattern in the brain. And so each time you catch yourself complaining, you have to move the wristband to the other hand and start over. You restart the clock.
21 days all over again.
Exactly. And the guy who came up with it, a minister who started this and then expanded it, you know, through his ministry, said it took him 8 months to get 21 days without complaining. So this little awareness process is extremely, extremely powerful, but it's a bigger job than most people would realize. And that's what you realize when you start doing that process, is how much you focus on things that don't serve you.
Right, exactly. I mean, how old was that? How old was he? Do you have any idea?
I've seen his picture. I haven't gone to his website in a while. Somewhere, you know, 40s, 50s.
So 40, 50 years of learning how to complain, growing those new neural connections.
Right.
And in eight months, we can might even say in as short as 8 months, he was able to break that habit.
Well, and And it's actually interesting. They don't count thinking a negative thought. They only count if it comes out of your mouth.
Right. Okay. All right. I got it.
Because otherwise it would never end.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, there's a couple that I met, you know, recently who made the commitment years ago to with each other to not speak negatively to each other in their presence. And I said, wow, that's amazing. A couple who never speaks negatively to each other. And they actually made that choice. And I said, well, how's it going? He's in his mid-60s. And he said, well, you know, for a while now, we've been able to really maintain that. And we know that when we're in each other's presence, there's a sense of safety and security in that. And it feels wonderful. So, I mean, that told me that you can really train your mind to do things that are really advantageous towards yourself. I mean, that doesn't mean they don't talk about difficult emotions or feelings or stuff like that that's there, but they're not condescending to each other. They don't judge each other, you know, in that
mm-hmm.
way.
Well, it's when people ask about the work that I do and what it takes, I say it's in the same way that medical people need to be desensitized and non-reactive to things like blood and smells and people screaming.
Uh-huh.
People that do the kind of work that I do have to get desensitized to weirdness. There's just some really strange things that you run into, and you have to be able to stay present and do what you're going to do without freaking out. Because if you freak out, it's dangerous. And there are all kinds of levels to that. It doesn't matter what your particular kind of work is. You know, school teachers have to be able to tolerate lots of kids making demands on them at the same time and still stay focused. So do moms, obviously, anyone who works with children. People who work in retail, especially at a counter, have to be able to deal with all the specifics at the same time that people's emotions are being thrown at them. There's all kinds of things that people learn to do, and they don't think about how they learn to do it. And then they go into the rest of their life and they go unconscious.
Yeah, and the question is, during all those times that the retailer person is sitting there and really kind of holding their, you know, biting their tongue because a customer is being rude, their shoulders are getting tense, their face is starting to tense, and they go home and they yell at their kids or they yell at their comes out kind of there. So I mean, the question is, in some ways, how do we hold that type of response in a way where our bodies might be reacting, but that we can recognize that becomes the body reacting in some way becomes in some ways our friend, because it's what our mind is primed to be aware of, and when it becomes aware of it, we're present. And again, we're sitting in a choice where we can choose to maybe do something that's going to be really helpful for ourselves, maybe by taking a few deep breaths or letting our shoulders down or something like that. There was a fascinating study that was done not too long ago by Paul Ekman at the University of California, San Francisco, where he brought, you know, a monk who had been practicing meditation for, you know, years and years and years, you know, thousands and thousands of hours. And he did something that with him that no scientist ever thought was possible before. And basically what he did is, we have this thing called the startle response, which means when we hear an explosion or, you know, we hear a gunshot, our body, you know, kind of reacts. And oftentimes it's the same five facial muscles in the face that contract. And what he did when he brought this guy in was he told him he was going to bring him through the simulation. And what he wanted him to try and do is really really suppress that startle response. And in the 1940s, there's another study that came out that basically deemed that impossible for any human to do. So here's this guy who has been doing this meditation for, you know, a very long time, more than any of us will probably ever do. And his body, when the gunshot went off, his heart rate went up, his body reacted, but his facial muscles didn't contract, or at least you could not tell that at all. And he put electrodes on him and different things like that. And so, you know, he was. And so what that says is that the physiological reactivity could arise within an environment of not reacting to it. The mind wasn't reacting to it. The body was startled, but the mind wasn't reacting to it. And that's something. Again, this guy's like the Olympic champion of of mindfulness meditation, you know, practitioners. But so we're not going to be exactly like that, but that doesn't really matter. The question is, in our everyday life, what does that mean for our everyday life? When we're talking about depression, or we're talking about anxiety, or we're talking about trauma, different traumas that we've had, or stress, everyday stress, how can it arise? How can we kind of train ourselves so that even smaller things like that, not a gunshot going off in our ear, but smaller things like that can arise without us reacting so much to it with things like complaining or blaming or drinking or smoking or gambling or, you know, any of these different things, the bad habits we get involved with. And that's the idea, that we can train ourselves to be less reactive and more aware in that space, to be able to more skillfully engage that next moment. And that's what's so fascinating, I think, about that research study. I'm just going to give you some examples of maybe some things that you can do that you can bring into your everyday life that can start training your mind to be more present. And this is stuff that has really worked for me, and it's worked for thousands of people. What I mean work is, it's really helped them start to more automatically recognize more of these spaces of awareness in their life without them having to constantly be trying so hard for it. I call them moments of grace. It's like a moment of awareness just kind of visits you. And so one of these is a basic one that you may have heard if you've listened to any of my talks before, is called the STOP practice, which is an acronym, and our brains love acronyms. And you can take this 1 minute practice with you here. You can do it now. You can take it with you right afterwards. But what I recommend is, since you know many of us are kind of tied to these digital phones, is if you use the calendar in there, just kind of plug this into your calendar and allow it to be a reminder in some way, or put it up as a sign in your cubicle if you work in a cubicle or anywhere. And so this stands for stop, take a few deep breaths. So you take a few deep breaths. That's meant to kind of pop you out of autopilot and help you become more present. And then you observe your experience that you're having right now. So your experience in any given moment includes your body, your emotions, and your thoughts. And so you just note, how is my body feeling right now? What position is my body in right now? Is there any tension in my body right now? And then you also notice your emotions. How am I feeling emotionally right now? Am I feeling stressed, anxious, sad, joyful, calm? And those also manifest physically in the body in some way. And so just being aware of that feeling, that emotion that's there, again, downregulates the amygdala, that fear circuit, that emotional circuit. Again, we're back to our emotions. And then basically we look at the last thing, which is our thoughts. Is our mind busy or is it calm? And we just note that. That's all. And the P stands for proceed. So proceeding by asking the question, what's most important for me to be paying attention to right now? And as we do this over and over again and practice it over our lives, that starts to become more automatic. And so we can, those books that we read that we love that we were mentioning earlier, Tuesdays with Maury, the last lecture, get us in touch with what matters in life. We can start walking alongside of those values more often because we're better at redirecting our attention to what actually matters in moment to moment. And so that's one practice that can help training you right now that only takes 1 or 2 minutes at a time. And I suggest doing that a couple times a day. And just not for the sake of that I'm suggesting you do it, but just to allow your experience to be your teacher. In other words, allow your experience to tell you, is this something that's worthwhile or not worthwhile?
Sounds good. David? I'm here. Can you hear me?
I hear you now.
Okay. Not sure exactly what happened. There was a question that we kicked around for just a few minutes before you got on, which is, how did you wind up with this approach? You know, what's your story? What's your path in going from what I assume was a fairly straightforward education in psychology to doing something that's really on the cutting edge?
Well, it's funny that you say that. I have these memories. Basically, right after my parents got divorced, I was about 6 years old. And I think at that moment, I had a lot of feelings, but I had no idea what to do with them. And a lot of anger, I had a lot of sadness, but I didn't really express any of that. There was a moment when they got divorced, my mom came up to me and said, because I had this kind of a stonewalled face, and she said, Elisha, do you understand what's happening? And I said, yeah, what do you want me to do, bang my head against the wall to cry? So I really didn't know. I really didn't know how to handle it. What was happening. And so I'd go, and I'd oftentimes go on little walks outside my neighborhood because it was safe back then, and just kind of reflect. And so I had this kind of reflective mentality, And as time went by, I fast forward to my early 20s, my early 20s, I was living in San Francisco working in the corporate world because I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I went to school, I studied psychology, I studied political science, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I went in the corporate world, and I worked hard and eventually got kind of sucked into a world where I was playing much harder. I was experimenting with kind of drugs and alcohol to a point of severe abuse, and as long as I was doing well in my job, I was doing sales and management for different corporations. As long as I was doing well, I figured everything was okay. But something deep inside me told me that it really wasn't. And there was one night where I found myself in a broken-down limousine south of Market Street in San Francisco with a guy that I swore that if I ever was caught with, I knew I would hit rock bottom. Because here's a guy that I'd seen in different clubs who had been up for days and days and days at a time, and he looked like a shadow of a human being. And there I was with him. And a moment kind of washed over me, which said, I don't need to do this. I don't need to be this way. You know, life's worth more than this. There's too many people that love me. I don't need to throw it all away. And that's a moment that I would consider to be kind of a now effect moment. It was a moment of awareness, even within my haze and kind of stupor. And I stepped outside a limousine and walked home, because you can do that in San Francisco because it's a small place. And that walked me into days of kind of opening up to a new way of seeing things and doing things. And that wasn't that I wish I could say that was the last time that I engaged in that behavior, and it wasn't, because that's just not how change happens usually. But over time, I started getting involved with more people who are interested in making positive change in their lives, understanding their minds, getting involved with mindfulness, and starting to train myself in it. And I chose to go to a school, a doctoral school, eventually after some resistance, that had mindfulness in its curriculum. And that was Palo Alto, called the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology at the time.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I kind of grew from there. I was really interested in the science behind it, the practice behind it, all the wonderful research that was coming out of all the ivory tower institutions, as well as just our own school that was there. And I did a research study of my own that was a national research study and published in the Journal of Clinical Psychology that took people around the country and gave them a practice to do for 5 minutes a day for 5 days a week for 3 weeks. And it showed statistically significant results in stress reduction, various areas of well-being. But more importantly was these interviews that I did with the people afterwards, because I did a qualitative part to the study. And the interviews boiled down to one thing. The people that changed the most experienced overwhelmingly a sense of connection. And that was connected with themselves or something greater than themselves, but it was connection just the same. And that was associated with all of these wonderful results. And so it made sense to me that what I want to do with my life and with other people's life is help them foster a greater sense of connection with themselves and potentially something greater than themselves if that's, you know, what their path is open to.
Well, what a gift you bring to people that are going through their own struggles and being able to say, I've been there and that's how I got here with this approach for you.
Yeah, I think a lot of people find this approach to their own pain. And I just think that's true. And you know, there's something to do with that caption of the wounded healer. And, you know.
Well, one of the themes that comes around frequently on the show is the idea of walkabout and going off into the wilderness, whatever the dark night of the soul looks like for that particular person.
Yeah.
If it's done as a ritual, then it's planned, but for most people it's not. And you suddenly realize that you don't have all the stuff that you were depending on, and here you are, what are you going to do now? And you learn all kinds of things. My personal view is that everybody's on walkabout. Most people just don't think about it. And certainly anybody who's a healer and doing anything where they're not mainstream is on walkabout constantly. And that challenge to find resources, whether you see them as within yourself or in spirit or however you think about it, is where the growth is.
Yeah. I love
and
the way
and the power.
I love the way that you say that, though. Everyone is on a walkabout, and many of them just aren't aware of it. And
well, especially, especially at this particular time with so much change going on the planet, in every conceivable way, climate and politics and economics and all kinds of things. There's nothing really that you can depend on and just try and float through without a whole lot of having to focus on anything, having to make your own choices. And that's why everybody is in such chaos and things, the emotions are running so high. But, you know, it's walkabout. It's the nature of walkabout.
Yeah, there's a rabbi and philosopher, I'm sure you've heard of him, Abraham Joshua Heschel,
mm-hmm.
had you know, wonderful quote that I picked out from one of his books that said, life is routine, and routine is resistance to wonder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And mindfulness really is coming back to the moments of wonder and seeing what's actually going on around you. And that's a basic principle in shamanism. You know, everything is connected, everything is conscious, but you don't get to experience that unless you're present in the moment.
That's right. Yeah. It comes down to that sense of presence. One of the things I didn't mention in my personal journey was I took a year-long course which kind of touched on this, which was in this guy's work called, his name was Sri Aurobindo, and he was, he did a tremendous amount of work out there. And it was a year-long course in reading basically his texts. One of the things I picked out in his text was the idea that in life, the things that we do that are good in some ways and this was my interpretation, are a way of kind of off, it was an offering to the rest of the world, meaning like when you do good things, that has a ripple effect onto other people.
Yeah.
It's an offering. And so the picture I had in my mind was in the olden days, in like the biblical times, when people did offerings, kind of sacrifices in some way to the gods or whatever. And in my mind, the word that I picked out was sacred. There's something sacred. And what I wanted to do with my life and with other people's lives is help them contact that sense of sacredness in their life. And I realized in order to even do that, like as you were saying, you have to be present. In order to be intentional with life and even contact that, I mean, it can happen at like a moment of grace during the day where it just kind of comes and contacts you without your intention at all or anything like that. That can happen. But if what we practice and repeat is kind of what we get.
Sure.
So the idea of becoming present so you can choose to contact what's sacred in life, is a dimension of depth that I'm sure you you bring to the table with shamanism.
Well, that's absolutely right. And it's fascinating how we've now pulled Jewish mysticism and psychology and all kinds of other threads together here. And thank you so much, because this is very exciting work. I really appreciate your taking the time with us and telling us about what you're doing. My guest tonight is Elijah Goldstein, PhD. His book is The Now Effect, How This Moment Can Change the Rest of Your Life. He's in private practice in West Los Angeles. And your website is ElijahGoldstein.com, and Elijah is spelled ELISHA. Is there any other contact information people should have for you?
I mean, you can Google me anytime. I'm all over the web because I write pretty frequently.
Right, because as soon as you start writing, everything is all over the place.
Right.
Are you doing any events in the near future? Anything else that people should know about?
Oh, good question. I have I've created this, you know, a very well received day-long seminar. It's more mainly for professionals in particular. That I do in L.A. and San Francisco, up in San Rafael, actually. And so the next one I think will be August 12th up in San Rafael. It's called The Power of Mindfulness and Psychotherapy. That's happening up there. I will be at Kripalu in January doing a workshop on the Now Effect. Kripalu is a great retreat center over in the Berkshires. Yeah, so I'll be doing that in January, and I'll be speaking at the Los Angeles County Psychological Association event in October, and a number of other events they're on the site.
Cool. Well, thank you again so much, and we'll continue this conversation.
This has been great.
I appreciate knowing you. Thanks so much for being with us. If people want to find my work, you'll find that at househealing.com. cleverlyhiding.com. Cleverly Hiding on the contact tab. You'll find every conceivable technology to get in touch with me, including my online scheduling calendar. I do a 20-minute complimentary initial interview, see what's going on with you and how my work might be helpful to you. So feel free to find me and make an appointment. Would love to be able to talk to you. So once again, we've taken a wonderful hour and learned all kinds of new things and had a great time. So thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll be with us next week. This is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio.